on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Monday, April 30th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Kurgia. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscasts and podcasts on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. And today in health news, we have Sharon Hundel talking about a new study about strategies for weight loss. With obesity rising and spring and summer around the corner, safe and effective weight loss is of top priority to many health organizations and nutritionists. Also, we will have Martin Lemlin's segment on tough politics in Ottawa.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
On our show on the 27th, we gave our UBC listeners an update on the Gage South land use hearings at UBC. On April 26th, UBC held a public hearing confirming Gage South's academic designation and finalizing the location of the new aquatic center and bus loop by amending the UBC land use plan. A new amendment to the land use plan also enables campus and community planning to transfer market housing density originally proposed for the UBC farm to Acadia East and Stadium Road. University Neighborhoods Association resident Claire Robson voiced opposition to the density transfers, which would allow campus and community planning to build a maximum amount of market housing density possible in Acadia East and Stadium Road, or else transfer it elsewhere on campus at a later date. UBC Insider's editor Neil Johnson, who submitted a petition with over 20,000 signatures to keep Gage South zoned as academic, as well as opposed density transfer, also spoke at the hearing. While Johnson congratulated campus and community planning for making the right choice on the designation of Gage South, he did question the density transfers. The hearing finished in less than an hour with only two speakers and one question on the location of the bus loop. 16 people were in attendance. Those who were unable to attend were able to submit emails or letters to be included in the public hearing. Campus and community planning received 16 submissions, and 14 were in regards to the bus loop. Campus and community planning have defended the amendment, saying the density transfers were always a part of the process, and any conversion of academic land for market housing would have to go through another amendment process. The land use plan amendments will be finalized at the June 12 Board of Governors meeting.
Researchers at the University of British Columbia have found that parents are surprisingly good at detecting anxiety disorders in kindergarten children if asked the right questions. Lead researcher Lynn Miller, an associate professor of education at UBC, said that in a study of 200 kindergartner children in BC's Lower Mainland, a test given to parents was 85% effective in identifying children who met the criteria for anxiety disorders. Dr. Miller presented the research at the American Educational Research Association annual meeting earlier this month in Vancouver. Dr. Miller explains that anxiety disorders take different forms in kindergartners than in adults. Red flags include persistent stomach aches, reluctance to go to sleep, or problems sleeping through the night in a separate room. And although it is normal for kids to feel jitters from time to time, Dr. Miller explains that the difference here is that children with anxiety disorders experience their fears as something catastrophic. Dr. Miller says that if left unchecked, anxiety disorders in kindergartners may lead to educational problems and increased risk of substance abuse, depression, and other mental health problems down the road. Studies have shown that up to 10% of kindergarten-aged children suffer from anxiety disorder, a rate that jumped more than 15% of high school to more than 15% of high school students. She also adds that although anxiety disorders are the most common mental health problem in children, they tend to get the least attention.
And now to give our campus listeners a brief update on the ongoing talks between the AMS and the security staff under the union, COPE 378. Recently, the AMS retracted letters of termination that were sent to all but five of its security staff. On April 17th, 19 of 24 staffers received letters informing them their employment would end at the beginning of May. While the AMS said the move formalized an existing policy, the union claimed that past practice had been only to verbally warn security staff that there would be fewer shifts available during the summer months. According to COPE 378, the union that represents the AMS security staff, lawyers from both sides met last week to discuss the impending termination. Last Friday, they reached an agreement that will allow security guards to pick up shifts during the summer. According to AMS President Matt Parson, security staff are understood to be employed only for the academic year. Parson said that, quote, the AMS has always and always will be a seasonal employer. Part of that is that we need employment mainly for the 8 months of the school year, and we have for quite some time hired on those terms, those start and end dates, end quote. The Security Guard Union and the AMS have been in mediation to reach a collective agreement since February, with the union citing issues about wages and job security. The AMS and the union's next mediation dates will be May 8th, 9th and 10th, according to President Matt Parson.
Union activists, labor supporters of all strikes, anarchists and occupiers plan to rally at the Vancouver Art Gallery from 3 p.m. onward Tuesday to mark May Day. Born from the violent struggles in the U.S. for the 8-hour workday in the late 19th century, International Workers' Day is celebrated as a national holiday in more than 80 countries. Since it is not a holiday here, Vancouver's event will culminate with speeches from 4 to 6 p.m. by the BC Federation of Labor, Vancouver and District Labor Council, and Occupy Vancouver. Occupier Tosh Hoyudo said that, quote, you're going to see a lot of occupiers and hopefully we'll see a lot of union members, end quote, noting that Occupy Vancouver stopped short of echoing calls in the U.S. for a general strike Tuesday because of the heavy fines unions here would face. After speeches, the crowd is expected to march from the gallery to W2 around 6:15 p.m., Hayato said the route will loop the art gallery clockwise, turn north on Burrard, and then east on Hastings. The protest party keeps going at 7:30 p.m. with the May Works Festival at W2 at 111 West Hastings Street. And here's a quick update on what Occupy Vancouver is up to these days. Since being evicted from the Vancouver Art Gallery last fall, Occupy Vancouver has secured a rental space at W2 for $1,200 a month and has been holding regular meetings. Recently, they've been organizing a free market event every other Sunday in Grandview Park on Commercial Drive, where people can drop off and pick up free items.
A new University of British Columbia study finds that analytic thinking can decrease religious belief, even in devout believers. The study, which appeared in the recent issue of the journal Science, finds that thinking analytically increases disbelief among believers and skeptics alike, shedding important new light on the psychology of religious belief. The study's lead author, Will Gervais, a PhD student in UBC's Department of Psychology, said that, quote, "Our goal was to explore the fundamental question of why people believe in a God to different degrees. A combination of complex factors influence matters of personal spirituality, and these new findings suggest that the cognitive system related to analytic thought is one factor that can influence disbelief," end quote. The researchers, who assessed participants' belief levels using a variety of self-reported measures, as well as problem-solving tasks, found that religious belief decreased when participants engaged in analytic tasks compared to participants who engaged in tasks that did not involve analytic thinking. The study's co-author and associate professor, Ira Narenzayan, UBC Department of Psychology, said that, quote, "Our study builds on previous research that links religious belief to intuitive thinking. Our findings suggest that activating the analytic cognitive system in the brain can undermine the intuitive support for religious belief, at least temporarily," end quote. The study involved more than 650 participants in the US and Canada. Will Gervais says future studies will explore whether the increase in religious disbelief is temporary or long-lasting, and how the findings apply to non-Western cultures.
The public inquiry to the Robert Picton case is shifting its focus to policies that could protect vulnerable women in a series of forums that will replace the courtroom format that has guided the hearings until now. The inquiry is divided into two parts: evidentiary hearings that are examining what happened in the failed Picton investigation, and a study commission that will focus on potential policy changes. Commission lawyer Art Vertilib said the study commission, which starts this week, is the most important part of the process because it will look forward at what needs to change. Vertilib says the detailed examination of why police failed to catch Picton in the early 1990s and the early 2000s is meaningless unless the commission looks for ways to make things better. Commissioner Walia Paul will hear from presenters on topics including the safety of Aboriginal sex workers, the relationship between the police and the public, and the police accountability. Several days of public forums are scheduled in addition to more formal testimony about the Picton investigation before the entire inquiry wraps up at the end of May.
And now we go to a quick segment by Sharon Hundle. She is our health news reporter, and she talked about a new study about strategies. About strategies for weight loss.
In health, we have a new just published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which is a highly regarded journal in the scientific community. I got the press release from the Dietitians of Canada member section. So the study covered whether lower calorie diets, which emphasized fat, carbohydrate, and protein, differentially reduced fat reserves or preserved lean mass. So the main conclusion was that a reduction in energy intake was the most important determinant of fat loss rather than the macronutrient composition of the diets. Now, this is big stuff, and why it's important is a good question. Basically, we hear it so often that people are so afraid of particularly high-fat foods when dieting, but this study proves that everything in moderation can still work. So you can now have a small portion of deep-fried food and get away with it without feeling too guilty. It's something that dietitians have been saying for a long time now, that there's really no good or bad food. So another thing to keep in mind is the results of this study parallel a misconception in eating for weight gain. Many people adopt high-protein diets with the hopes of putting on muscle mass that would increase your mass, but several studies indicate that it's a total increase in calories from a variety of foods, not just high-protein sources, which is the best way to increase mass. So the lesson today is that a well-balanced diet that is in your desired caloric range for weight gain or weight loss is recommended. So visiting Dietitians of Canada website at dietitians.ca under Your Health for more information and resources is a really good way to get on track with having a safe and healthy weight loss regimen. So I'm Sharon Hundel for CITR News in Vancouver. Thanks, and I'll be back next week with other dietetic students to cover more health coverage. Thanks.
Thank you to Sharon Hundel for that new health news segment. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This May in Discorder, sit down for a chat with local thrash punk sensations New Sensei. Get well acquainted with Peace before their new album drops. Find out if Weed the Band is better than The Substance. And discover the response from members of Breastronaut on the controversies surrounding bands and crowdsourced funding. As always in Discorder, get your healthy dose of Venue News, Filmstrip, take a look at our beautiful calendar, browse the always-changing CITR program guide, tuck up bits of Mark DeLong's art project on your bedroom walls, take in some reviews of music both recorded and live, and all the other goodies you know and love. Pick up your beautiful and free copy of Discorder at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, don't forget to check out Discorder at discorder.ca. Discorder, that magazine from CITR, supporting local music for over 25 years.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. We are broadcasting live from the Student Union Building on the University of British Columbia. I am Martin Lemelin, and it is now time for your weekday weather forecast with fantastic Phil Chang. How are you, Phil?
Great. Thank you, Martin. Always good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to hear yours as well.
Good evening, listeners. Judging from instrumental data, the first week of May will be a gloomy one, with daily doses of precipitation. Take today, for example. We have an isolated low cell passing over us as I speak, stirring up active weather. Our stability is conditional at best, near the surface, and becomes outright unstable as we probe higher up into the atmosphere. The latest skew T chart taken at the Vancouver airport shows the temperature and the dew point lines are overlapping, indicative that the air in this region is near saturation. This means any upward motion will likely result in moisture condensing into clouds, which leads to, you guessed it, precipitation. Well, today's profile quite adequately reflects what is the norm over the next few days. So although the summer term is starting, I wouldn't recommend anyone putting on their breezy summer clothing yet. Now, here's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, 90% chance of precipitation, low of 10. Tuesday, 80% chance of precipitation, it'll be windy, speeds reaching up to 20 kilometers per hour, high of 11, low of 8. Wednesday, overcast, with 50% chance of showers, high of 11, low of 10. Thursday, overcast with a 50% chance of rain in the evening, high of 12, low of 6. And Friday, overcast with a 70% chance of rain, high of 12, low of 8. So that's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently, it is 12 degrees Celsius on campus at Oak Ridge Mall, reporting for News 101. I'm Phil Chang.
Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, CJ.
And that was our intrepid weather reporter, Phil Chang, from the UBC Storm Club. And now it's time for your provincial and national headlines.
A Vancouver-based mining company, Taseko Mines Limited, is pushing the Harper government to reconsider a controversial gold-copper mining project in the BC interior, and has privately urged Ottawa to ignore Aboriginal requests to consider First Nations, quote, spirituality as a factor in their determination. This is according to a letter that Taseko Mines President Russell Halbar sent to Environment Minister Peter Kent. This letter was obtained under the Access to Information Act and provided to the Vancouver Sun by BC Independent MLA Bob Simpson. Taseko, which failed in its 2010 bid to get federal approval after a scathing federal review, also asked Ottawa not to permit prayer ceremonies at pending hearings on the revised proposals. Taseko president also told Kent in his letter that children's plays being performed at the panel should also be banned. The company also complained that one of the three panel members, metallurgist and former environmental mining supervisor Natalie Morin, was a member of a First Nations organization in an area that was opposed to the project. However, several First Nations leaders responded to this letter as an affront to the First Nations spirituality, including Silkotin Guetin Chief Marilyn Baptiste. A federal panel appointed under the Canadian Environment Assessment Act ruled in 2010 against allowing the proposed Prosperity Mine to proceed. The federal panel report was filled with comments on the cultural and spiritual importance to local First Nations of Taseko's property, and especially Fish Lake, which Taseko planned to drain and turn into a tailings dump.
A 27-year-old woman has died a tragic death after falling out of a hang glider off Mount Woodside near Agassiz, B.C. Lenami Godinez fell out of the hang glider and plunged 300 meters to her death while her boyfriend, who had bought her the hang gliding experience for their anniversary, watched in horror. The pilot involved in the accident, identified as William Jonathan Orders, was arrested after the incident and charged with, quote, an allegation that he withheld potential key evidence which could help determine whether he played a role in any wrongdoing, end quote, said RCMP Corporal Tammy Hollingsworth. Though there is nothing to suggest it was anything but an accident, police are still investigating, and since the pilot was contracted to provide the service, potential civil charges are possible.
What began as a provincial policy spat over tuition hikes in Quebec has transformed in just over a year into a movement of broader student unrest now receiving some international attention. In the last few days, Quebec student protests have received coverage in French news outlets like Le Monde and Agence France-Presse. In Australia and New Zealand, on Al Jazeera, and in the U.S., including on CNN. The French-Canadian students have been cited as an example in the tuition debates as part of an international outcry against the high price of education. The annual tuition for a private university in the U.S. is over $30,000 a year, with collective student debt poised to reach $1 trillion, which is even more than all the credit card debt in that country. Two protesters were arrested today following a scuffle outside a community college in Sherbrooke, Quebec. Several dozen students wearing red square strike emblems had gathered at the college to denounce the fact that the classes had resumed under a court order. A person who tried to cross the picket line was physically accosted, and a skirmish broke out as video cameras rolled. Though no one had any more knowledge on where this protest will go and how much longer it will continue, we congratulate our Quebecois comrades on having the bravery to fight tuition.
And now we go to a segment by Martin Lemelin.
A couple of weeks ago, a surprise contender for the NDP leadership, Nathan Cullen, was named the party's House leader. So now he's in charge of the NDP's day-to-day dealings in the House of Commons, a supposed expert on parliamentary procedure. Cullen's either looking to rock the boat or isn't very familiar with parliamentary procedure at all. The new House leader came out today and called for more civility and decorum in the House. And he said it with a straight face, too. The NDP wants Speaker Andrew Scheer to penalize MPs who don't heed his warnings for courtesy and respect. But just how does the NDP expect Scheer to penalize supposedly honorable members of Parliament? Well, by taking their question period questions away from them.
and not only disrespectful individuals should be disciplined. No, Colin's calling for entire parties to lose their question period privileges if its members engage in coarse and impertinent conduct. Of course, this is a great idea. As Colin points out himself, most of us aren't allowed to scream at or demean people we work with, so why or how can it be tolerated by our elected officials? The fact is that not only is it tolerated, it's so deeply embedded in the charade that is the parliamentary question period that seriously talking about eliminating it is flat-out wingnut fantasy. Or just another battle cry for New Democrats. But I don't want to be the cynical voice that poo-poos this idea without giving it proper consideration. So how's about you and I do a bit of digging to find out if civility in Parliament has any connection to reality, or if it's just another wonderful oxymoron to be inserted into the popular lexicon. So let's ask Bob Ray for a coaching tip or two when addressing the House.
Don't raise your voice, talk in a calm voice. There are many members here who do it very well and many members who don't do it so well. Avoid responding to idiotic heckling coming from the other side. Not a good idea. The people who are watching on television can't hear the inane comments that are being made on the opposite side, Madam Speaker, so there's no need to respond to them.
Idiotic heckling? In the House of Commons? I don't believe it. I can't believe it. I refuse to believe that the leaders of our country today would stoop to such lowly depths usually reserved for drunken hockey fans who, although well into their 30s and 40s, continue to routinely piss themselves.
Well, Mr. Speaker, my honorable colleague, if she had been in Durban, would have seen that, in fact, Canada was among the leaders in creating the...
Order. Order.
Oh yes, I forgot about Justin Trudeau's recent abhorrent and unparliamentary use of language to provide a stunningly accurate description of Environment Minister Peter Kent's physical characteristics. How did old Andrew deal with that bit of vulgarity?
After question period.
I can't understand what Cullen's worried about. Andrew Scheer obviously rules with an iron fist already. But you can surely appreciate how this language might impede the democratic process. In defense of Le Petit Trudeau, at least he didn't endlessly repeat misleading, convoluted tripe like Dean Del Maestro when dealing with the robocall scandal.
Before continuing these baseless smears, they should prove that their own callers are in fact not behind these reports. Before continuing these baseless smears, they should prove their own callers are not behind these reports. Before continuing these baseless smears, they should prove that their own callers are not behind these reports, Mr. Speaker. Before continuing these baseless smears, the baseless smears the member is making again right now, they should prove that their own callers are not, in fact, behind these reports. The opposition paid millions of dollars to make hundreds of thousands of phone calls. Party paid millions of dollars to contact hundreds of thousands, I would argue probably millions of voters right across this country. What is clear and what is factual in this case is that the Liberals made millions of calls. They spent millions of dollars to contact hundreds of thousands of Canadians.
Speaker, I wonder if getting the same answer twice qualifies as a robo-answer, but my question is to the Prime Minister.
Wowee. Don't you just swell with pride when you hear the cream of this country's crop hard at work like that? Maybe I'm just susceptible. You know, I do have a soft spot for senseless gibberish, which has nothing to do with Vic Taves. When Vic gets down and dirty with his opponents, it always makes sense.
We are proposing to bring measures to bring our laws into the 21st century and provide police with the lawful tools that they need. He can either stand with us or with the child pornographers.
I never get sick of hearing Vic basically accuse his fellow members of Parliament of being accessories to pedophilic crimes.
He can either stand with us or with the child pornographers.
Well, at this point, I think we can say that civility in Parliament is, at best, a farce. And we haven't even gotten to the Big Daddy yet. The all-powerful and titillating fetish of rotten politics, Adolf Hitler.
Senator Sharon Carson has said the following. The registering of hunting rifles is the first step in the social re-engineering of Canadians. Mr. Speaker, can you believe that statement? The social re-engineering of Canadians. Mr. Speaker, That is what Adolf Hitler tried to do in the 1930s. The long gun registry is, at its core, solely about an idea that the liberals of the 90s had, that guns are inherently evil and must be taken out of the hands of the general population. Again, who does that sound like?
The current incarnation of the conservative cabinet has really a weird and kinky obsession with Hitler. That was Larry Miller, an MP from Owen Sound, comparing Canadians who are skeptical of scrapping long gun registry to Hitler. And he's not alone. Why, just last week, John Baird brought it up again in a lame attempt to lambaste the official opposition.
The NDP don't support sending troops abroad for anything, Mr. Speaker. Let's look at the former leader of the NDP CCF when he said the following. I would ask whether we are to risk the lives of our Canadian sons to prevent the actions of Hitler. Do you know who said that, Mr. Speaker? The former leader of the NDP CCF, J.S. Woodsworth.
2014.
The best part of that clip are all the sheep cronies in the background echoing Baird's rhetorical questions. Like annoying little hangers-on who hang around the popular kid because their own self-esteem is unredeemably crippled. Little scavengers floating with the big fish. In this case, the biggest fish of them all is Stephen Harper. And don't make the mistake of thinking he's above this Hitler habit.
The NDP, leader of the NDP in 1939, didn't even want to support war against Hitler.
It's probably worth noting that the NDP didn't even come into existence until 16 years after the end of World War II. So not only is the conservative government using the most mainstream villain ever to walk on two legs as a sort of referential prop to support their policies, they aren't even taking care to make sure their Adolf allegations are accurate. And it surely is telling that even the man on top, the Prime Minister, the Honorable Stephen Harper, isn't even above, as old Dean Del Maestro would say, unsubstantiated smears. So, Nathan Cullen, the NDP's new House leader, you want civility in Parliament, eh? Well, that's a cute idea, and best of luck to you, sir. I hope it works out well. But for those of us anchored to reality, even the term civility in Parliament is as oxymoronic as civil war itself. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemon.
And big thanks to Martin Lemon for that segment. Those were provincial and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international news and an interview brought to you by Democracy Now!
Well, do you, Bunk?
The Rio Theatre is your independent East Vancouver theatre, playing first-run feature films, independent film screenings, as well as live events. Every Friday night, there are featured midnight cult classics on the big screen, and no one can beat the Rio for their cheap date Tuesdays. This May, movies are back at the Rio. Fridays at 11 p.m., there's no better place to be than at the Rio Theatre for classics such as Battle Royale, Purple Rain, The Dark Crystal, and Jackie Brown. As always, ticket prices are reduced for midnight movies if you arrive in costume, so dress to impress. Special events this month at the Rio include May 16th, open mic night at the Rio with East Fans Got Talent, starting at 8 p.m. Alan Doyle performing live Wednesday, May 23rd, also at 8 p.m. May 30th, get your nerd on with the live Dungeons & Dragons comedy experience. Join Vancouver's best comedic performers the last Wednesday of every month as they quest for glory and snacks in this live, improvised spectacular. Did we mention that movies are back at the Rio? For more information on all this and more, check out theriotheatre.ca.
...2011 marks the 25th anniversary of the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden since opening in 1986. The Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden is very pleased to have been able to connect cultures and communities for the past 25 years and continue being an arts and cultural hub in the neighborhood and the city. Watch for complimentary specials on the 25th day of every month. There are also blockbuster exhibits, community events, academic conferences, and music and theater productions lined up, plus contests and giveaways. CITR 101.9 FM is proud to be a year-long partner as the Garden celebrates its 25th anniversary. For more information, visit www.vancouverchinesegarden.com.
Show your Friends of CITR card or simply mention that you heard about the garden on CITR to receive $2 off admission.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Martin Lemlin. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you very much for being with us.
And now, for our international news, we go to an interview by Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez talk to Michelle Richardson, the legislative counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union, on the bill called CISPA, or the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, which is headed to the U.S. House of Representatives for a vote. This bill is highly controversial because it would allow private internet companies like Google, Facebook, and Microsoft to hand over troves of confidential consumer records and communications to the National Security Agency, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security, effectively legalizing a secret domestic surveillance program already run by the NSA.
Lines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. A legislative battle has erupted on Capitol Hill over a controversial House bill that critics say would allow private internet companies to hand over troves of confidential customer records and communications to the National Security Agency and other agencies. In a letter on Monday, 18 Democratic House members warned that unless specific limitations were put in place, the bill, quote, would for the first time grant non-civilian federal agencies, such as the National Security Agency, unfettered access to information about Americans' internet activities and allow those agencies to use that information for virtually any purpose. The bill is titled the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or simply CISPA. Backers of the legislation say it is needed to help private companies crack down on foreign entities, including the Chinese and Russian governments, committing online economic espionage that is stealing trade secrets from U.S. corporations and the government. But the bill has faced widespread criticism from online privacy advocates and even the Obama administration.
On Thursday, the White House threatened to veto the legislation, saying, quote, the sharing of information must be conducted in a manner that preserves Americans' privacy, data confidentiality, and civil liberties, and recognizes the civilian nature of cyberspace. Cybersecurity and privacy are not mutually exclusive, they said. Critics also say the bill would essentially legalize a secret domestic surveillance program already being run by the National Security Agency. Last week, a former top NSA official appeared on Democracy Now! To give his first TV interview. William Benny said domestic surveillance is already expanding under the Obama administration.
Actually, I think the surveillance has increased. In fact, I would suggest that they've assembled on the order of 20 trillion transactions about U.S. citizens with other U.S. citizens.
How many?
20 trillion.
Where do you get the number 20 trillion?
Just by the numbers of telecoms, it appears to me from the questions that CNET posed to them in 2006. And they published the names and what the responses were. I looked at that and said that anybody that equivocated was participating, and then estimated from that the numbers of transactions. That, by the way, estimate only was involving phone calls and emails. It didn't involve any queries on the net or any assembles, financial transactions or credit card stuff, if they're assembling that. I do not know that.
National Security Agency whistleblower William Binney. To see the full interview with him, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We're joined now by two guests. Michelle Richardson is with us in Washington, D.C., legislative counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. Jacob Applebaum is back with us again here in Democracy Now! Studios in New York, computer security researcher, developer, and advocate for the Tor Project, a system that enables its users to communicate anonymously on the Internet. Michelle, let's begin with you. Talk about this legislation, this bill, that is expected to be voted on this week. Debates beginning today.
CISPA, the bill that will come up later today and probably be voted on tomorrow, will create an exception to all existing privacy laws so that companies can share very sensitive and personal information directly with the government, including military agencies like the National Security Agency. And then once the government has it, they can repurpose it and use it for a number of things, including an undefined national security use. The violations of privacy are just amazing under this bill, and it's even invoked a veto threat from the Obama administration.
And specifically in terms of the new powers that this grant, what does this do to existing laws that protect the privacy of American citizens and requires the government to get even FISA warrants when it wants to actually do surveillance in particular situations?
Right. Current law now creates a presumption of privacy in our phone calls, emails, and internet records. And they say that companies have to keep them private unless there's an emergency or the government serves them with a subpoena or warrant. And in one fell swoop, this bill will say that these privacy laws simply no longer apply. So all of the process afforded under those laws, the protections, the congressional reporting, the role of a judge, all of that is swept away in one bill and will allow companies to decide how much and what type of information they want to turn over to the government. And it can include incredibly sensitive information like the content of emails or internet use history. And there's no obligation on the companies to extract the personally identifiable information. And that's the important thing to remember here, that information sharing may be a good thing. There are ways that it could be done where companies would share technical data with the government that wouldn't invade privacy, but that's not what we're talking about. This bill is incredibly broad and will allow the companies to turn over even the personally identifiable information.
The chief author of CISPA, Republican Congressmember Mike Rogers, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee and a former FBI agent, when he introduced the bill in November, predicted privacy advocates would oppose the legislation.
I expect that some will allege that the bill creates a new wide-ranging government surveillance program. This is false. The bill has nothing to do with government surveillance. It simply provides clear authority to the private sector, not the government, to identify and share cyber threat information. And remember what the threat is: up to $1 trillion a year in lost intellectual property. The one thing that has set America apart from every other nation is our innovation and our intellectual property. If we lose that game, we lose this fight. Moreover, the bill only permits sharing of cybersecurity threat information when a company is engaged in the protection of its own systems or networks or those of the corporate customer. Our bill does not require anyone to provide information to the government. Any sharing of information with the government is completely voluntary every step of the way. A government surveillance program that doesn't require any information privileged to the government shouldn't be a very good surveillance program. I couldn't believe it. It's an old FBI guy. We would say that is an unworkable event.
House Intelligence Chair, Michigan's Republican Congressmember Mike Rogers, unveiling the legislation at a meeting hosted by the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, a lobbying powerhouse. The association's president, Michael Powell, praised the legislation. Powell is the former chair of the Federal Communications Commission and the son of former Secretary of State General Colin Powell.
It's not an exaggeration to say when it comes to cybersecurity, what you don't know can hurt you. And one of the most valuable aspects of this legislation is it deals with the most critical problem when industries and government face a challenge like this: inadequate information flow. You can't fix what you don't know. You can't work in cooperation and coordination with others when you're not able to effectively share information. I think the legislation we'll hear about today takes a dramatic and important step.
That was Michael Powell, formerly chair of the FCC. Michelle Richardson, your response.
Well, the advocacy and civil liberties community is united in their opposition to this bill. We all believe that this is an unjustifiable infringement on privacy. And while the sponsors speak about limitations, they're just not in the bill. We're being asked to just trust the companies and the NSA to work in secret and protect our privacy. And we know from the warrantless wiretapping scandal after 9/11, when these groups are allowed to work in private like this, they're going to invade our privacy.
Well, Michelle Richardson, there's been apparently a series of amendments proposed, some of them by liberal Democrats like John Lewis and others, who are hoping to make portions of this legislation more palatable. Your sense of these attempts at soothing the rough edges of this legislation, but leaving it essentially intact?
Well, last night, the House Rules Committee decided which amendments would actually get a vote on the floor tomorrow. And they decided that amendments offered by Mr. Lewis or Jan Schakowsky or some of the other progressive members simply will not get a floor vote. And these were incredibly important amendments that would have squarely made Congress decide whether the military and the NSA would be able to collect internet records on innocent Americans. But Congress will not be able to vote on that this week. And instead, they'll just have to vote no on the entire bill to send the message that they don't want the military surveilling internet.
Interestingly, the legislation was co-sponsored by Democratic Congressmember Dutch Ruppersberger, the ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee. He's denied the bill would increase surveillance.
What the bill basically does is, in 1947, there was a bill, the intelligence bill, that really created what the rules and regulations were for CIA, NSA, and all of the intelligence agencies. And what this bill basically does is allow a government entity, in most situations, the NSA here, it allows them to give information to the private sector. The 1947 bill says if it's classified information, you cannot give it to the other side. And how the bill really came together was this DIB pilot program. It's a pilot program that allowed the NSA, working with the providers, AT&T, it was Verizon and Quest, and allowed them to give that information over to the private companies to work to help protect themselves. That worked extremely well, and as a result of that, we kind of modeled our bill after that.
Now, interestingly, the Obama administration at this point says that they would veto this, but that's Democratic Congressmember Dutch Ruppersberger. And among those who are supporting the legislation are major companies, ones that have actually opposed SOPA, the Stop Online Privacy Act. For example, Google. Mm-hmm. And then there's Facebook and these other companies. What do they have to gain, and what are the companies that are supporting it?
Last I heard, all of the major corporations that are involved with the internet are supporting this CISPA, the Rogers bill. And frankly, they're going to make out like bandits. Under this bill, if they share our private information, they get complete protection from liability. Consumers will no longer be able to assert their privacy rights that exist under current law and hold them accountable in court. They can't be prosecuted by the government like they currently can for illegal wiretapping or sharing information. They're getting FOIA exemptions so that no one will ever know about these breaches or the things that they share with the government. They're really walking away here with maximum flexibility to share our personal information with minimum accountability and no enforcement to make sure that they're not oversharing and infringing on our privacy.
So, Michelle Richardson, what are the prospects of this legislation passing first in the House and obviously then it would also have to pass in the Senate? And how would the White House react to its possible passage?
Well, we were very, very pleased to see that the Obama administration issued a veto threat yesterday and said in very clear terms that they believe that control of the internet needs to remain civilian and the military shouldn't be routinely collecting information on innocent people. We expect the bill to probably pass tomorrow, but we expect a strong no vote. And even just a month ago, if this bill had been brought to the floor, it probably would have sailed through without much amendment at all. But the online organizing and the organizing by the advocacy community over the last month has really changed the game, and the members are more educated, and I think we're going to see a very strong no vote from both Democrats and Republicans tomorrow.
Michelle Richardson.
Now, the Senate has its own alternative and is slated to vote on their bill in May, and it does include more protections. So it will come down to a conference between the House and the Senate to see which bill prevails.
Michelle Richardson, Legislative Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. When we come back, Jacob Applebaum is back with us, Computer Security Research. researcher. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
And thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Michelle Richardson, the Legislative Counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union, talking about the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA, in the U.S. House of Representatives. And for more international headlines,
we will go to Free Speech Radio News.
And before we do, I'd just like an update on the existential crisis of life, a.k.a., as Martin so nicely put it.
Oh, the summertime blues.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Now, as we all well know, I was going through this last week, and I've come out strong with some advice for people who are feeling the same thing. I kind of proactively engaged in job searches. I actually have a book here on existential literature. Just started reading a little more books, and all of a sudden, my life was back on track. And I think that would be my main piece of advice going through this summertime blues. I'd say seek opportunities wherever they may hide, and the existential blues just might go away. And here we have FSRN News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, April 30th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a deadly U.S. drone attack hits Pakistan as legal experts and residents challenge the covert program. In Syria, government-led attacks continue and thousands remain in detention despite a UN-backed effort to stop the violence. And we'll go to Arizona, where immigrants and indigenous people rally for human rights. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Bahrain's Court of Cassation ordered a new trial today for 14 jailed activists, including hunger striker Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja. All were convicted in a military court for their roles in last year's pro-democracy demonstrations. The new trial will be a civil one. But Al-Khawaja's wife says the civil system is no different than the military courts. Same judges, different clothes.
So nothing will change. It's the same system. They're just buying time.
There are no plans to release the activists during the legal proceedings. Al-Khawaja is on day 82 of his fast. His family claims he was sedated, restrained, and force-fed last week. Authorities say he authorized the nasogastric tube feeding. 11 people died in a suicide attack on a police convoy in Nigeria's Taraba State today. And yesterday, 16 people were killed at a university in northern Nigeria. Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
The victims were killed during Sunday worship services at the Bayero University in the northern city of Kano. The attack is believed to have been carried out by the Islamist group Boko Haram and is the second on the university campus within 4 days. The group is opposed to Western-styled education and had earlier threatened to attack schools and universities. Also Sunday, 5 people died during an attack on a church in the northern city of Maiduguri. The priest and 4 parishioners were killed in the sanctuary. Boko Haram has claimed responsibility for a spate of killings in recent months, including last week's attack on newspaper offices, which claimed 6 lives. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated group is fighting for the imposition of Islamic rule in Nigeria. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
More than 175,000 students in Quebec are in their 12th week of a strike against the provincial government's plan to boost tuition fees by 75%. FSRN's Lillian Bachter has more.
Students in Montreal will take to the streets again on Monday evening in their 7th night protest in a row. Yesterday, one of 3 striking student groups turned down an offer from the government to phase in the tuition increase over 7 years, rather than the previous plan of 5 years. But at the rates proposed, this would actually boost the overall tuition fee increase. Last week, negotiations broke down between Quebec's education minister, Lynn Beauchamp, and the 3 student groups, when the minister kicked one of them, CLASS, out of the talks. On Sunday, CLASS unanimously rejected the Liberal government's offer. The other two student associations call the offer shocking and will give their official response later this week. With the semester almost over, protests and harsh police repression to the demonstrations continue. Lillian Bochter, FSRN.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for that newscast. For more international headlines, you can find more international headlines at fsrn.org.
And that is our program for today, April 30th, 2012. Today's newscast is brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You could subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for another edition.